Okay, it's 11 o'clock or 6 p.m. in Israel, Erev Lag BaOmer, almost Mamash Lag BaOmer. And I want to welcome back, Shuli, of course, part three of the middle section of our five-part series. And today is, I think, the founding of the state, the war on independence, the founding of the state of Israel. And Vakasha Shuli.
Okay, hi everybody. So we have a very full and very interesting lecture today. I'm going to start with a very short disclaimer. This is an enormous topic, okay? Books have been written about 1948. People spend their whole career studying the War of Independence. We are not going to cover everything. We are going to talk about some of the major highlights. We're going to get a big picture timeline. Get a sense of some of the important battles, but we're definitely not covering everything. So, don't feel that you know it all by the time you're done here. But we are going to talk about the road to independence, the War of Independence, the picture that I brought you here. We actually have a lot of amazing pictures from 1948. It's astounding, actually, considering how traumatizing it was. But there were people who had the presence of mind to take pictures. And this is a picture of a convoy bringing supplies to Jerusalem, right? Bringing supplies to the besieged city. And we're going to see that the roads are critical in 1948 to 1947, 1948. Places that are cut off, like the Negev, like Gush Etzion, areas in the Galilee, and of course, Jerusalem. Those are very, very significant in the course of the war and in the choice of what battles to make. The War of Independence is, and hopefully always will remain, the most devastating of Israel's wars. 6,000 people were killed. Now, if you say, oh, that number doesn't sound so big, even though, of course, every person is a whole world, but realize that it's not just 6,000. Think of it in terms of the percentage of the population. This is 1% of Israel's population, okay? Besides the fact that these are only the people who are killed. There are also so many people who are wounded, who are traumatized. There really is not a family in the new state of Israel who is not affected in some way by this war. Okay. Add to that we have many of the fighters are literally coming off the boat, refugees from the Holocaust or coming in from Arab countries. It's a very complicated story. On the other hand, it's an incredibly positive story because we did it. Here we are. We have an independent state. We have sovereignty for the first time in 2,000 years. And I always point out, and I think it's an astounding thing, if you were to write a novel where you would say, in 1945, there was this horrible, incredible tragedy, the worst thing that ever happened to the Jewish people. 6 million were murdered. And 3 years later, the same people created an independent state. And any book critic, book reviewer would read it and say that that's not believable. Don't write it like that. And that's what happened. And it's a miracle. It's an astounding miracle. And I think we have to be aware of that before we even get started. So we're going to do a little bit of a review. People who've been coming to the last two, some of this will be a little familiar, but we're really going to be focusing on the 1948 stuff. We're going to step in and do one thing from last time, and then we're going to dive right in. Okay, so just to get our basic timeline, of course, British Mandate. That's what we spent a lot of our time on last time, from the end of World War I, 1918, until they leave in May of 48. Already in 37, okay, the British realize that they need to divide up the land in some way. The conflicts have been escalating, like we mentioned last time. Arab nationalism is growing, Jewish nationalism is growing. The Peel Commission in 1937, we'll take a look at what it looks like. That's their report. It doesn't actually get put into practice, but that's the first, one of the preliminary reports. There are a bunch of different possibilities, but we're going to focus on this one. 10 years later, November 29th, 1947, the UN has its historic vote on partition to create a Jewish state, an Arab state, and an international Jerusalem. Very next day, the war breaks out. And one of the things that's important to understand is the war is essentially divided into two pieces. Okay? From November 30th, 47 until May 15th, 48, is a war that is local. Okay, it doesn't mean the Arab countries don't support this war, but they cannot invade the country because the British are still here. They're not attacking the British. So everything is a local war. Local Arabs getting support from the countries around. Once the British leave May 15th, then the Arab nations around us officially declare war and invade. So those are the two sections. They're both important, but they're different. Okay? The first section has a lot of, I guess, what we would call today terror attacks, right? Attacks on convoys bringing supplies to Jerusalem, to the Negev, Gush Etzion, the Galilee, okay? Also more standard, unfortunately, terror attacks, okay? Attacks on Ben Yehuda and the Jewish agency, right? Downtown Jerusalem, attacks on those bringing supplies to Gush Etzion, the story of the Lamed Hay. The situation in Jerusalem becomes very bad. And by the beginning of April, even though the British are still here, Ben-Gurion orders battles to take the road to Jerusalem. And by that point, the battles have just broken out. The Haganah takes Haifa at the end of April. In the beginning of May, they take Tzfat. But May is a complicated month, right? If you look at a graph of, from the Jewish perspective, the highs and lows of the War of Independence, May is both the highest and the lowest, right? On the one hand, May is the month in which we declare the state. On the other hand, May is the month where we are being besieged from all sides. Gush Etzion falls, the Jewish quarter falls, the Negev is being attacked, okay? So very complicated months. Of course, May 14th, the 5th of Iyar, Israel declares statehood. And the very next day, the Arab nations around us declare war. And the end of May, the Jewish quarter falls. The end of May, the Egyptians are turned back in their march towards Tel Aviv. After trying to take the road to Jerusalem, Israel constructs an alternative road, the Burma Road. By September, the battles are over in Jerusalem. And by November, there's been a ceasefire in Jerusalem. But other parts of the country, the war continues. And it's only March 1949 that we have the final battle. The Haganah takes the Negev all the way down to Eilat, and the war is over. Okay, and 6 months later, we have the first soldiers in the new cemetery on Mount Herzl. So we're going to talk about that at the end as well. Okay. Just seeing sound, people are complaining, but it sounds like it's local. Okay, so let's just take one step back to what we talked about last time, which is that as Jewish nationalism is growing, Arab nationalism is growing as well. The Mufti of Jerusalem, Haj Amin al-Husseini, incites to various riots. The most dramatic and terrible are the ones of 1929, okay, 1929, which most of us are familiar with in Hebron, but not only Tzfat, Jerusalem, Gush Etzion, all over. And in response, the British have a whole commission, the Shoah Commission, and their basic conclusion is, well, it's the Jews who incited by wanting to do all sorts of things at the Western Wall, like bring in chairs, Rahman al-Itzmatlan, right? Bringing in chairs, bringing in a machitza, blowing the shofar. And the Jews have to be restricted because they are taking over these holy places. And that's not right. And that's inciting the Arabs. Okay. Besides other restrictions that the British put into place, but the Kotel is a big one. Now the Jews respond. Okay? They respond in a few different ways. First of all, early on, already in 1930, when the British forbid blowing the shofar at the Kotel, okay, 1930, you have a young Chabad Chassid who belongs to a division of the Beitar movement. And he, on Yom Kippur, he gets to the Kotel and he says, I realize this is not a commandment, but this is something that Jews have been doing for centuries and it shows our presence in this place. And he manages to get a shofar and to blow the shofar at the end of the Yom Kippur service, where, of course, right afterwards, he's arrested by the British. He's brought to the prison in the Tower of David, to the Kishla, what today is we call the Tower of David. And he's left there without any food, right? Yom Kippur, he's not given anything until Rav Kook, all right, Rav Kook shows up and says, I'm not going to break my fast until you release this man, and they release him. But from that point on, from 1930 to 1947, there's always a volunteer, a young man who would show up on Yom Kippur, always someone different because this way it keeps the British guessing, show up on Yom Kippur, smuggle in a shofar and blow the shofar, less as a sign of religion and more as a sign of defiance of the British. And if you're interested in the story, it's an amazing story. And this picture in the middle is all the chauffeur blowers who were gotten together for a movie that was made by, Weisberg. I can't remember what he calls himself. But if you YouTube chauffeur blowers, you'll find it. It's a beautiful movie where he interviews all of these guys. And then he brings them together at the hotel to blow the chauffeur, right? So that's the picture in the middle. Now, the other response is in 1937, the Beitar movement creates something called Plugata Kotel, the Kotel Brigade, basically, where they establish themselves in headquarters in the Jewish quarter in Jerusalem, with their goal being to protect the worshipers who are walking to the Kotel, because they were being harassed and attacked by the Arabs on the way, to protect the Kotel, to make sure that animals are not being brought through, right? All the disrespect that was going on, and to take over this job of chauffeur blowing. Now, the British disband them. They throw them out after about a year, but it's a powerful story. And today there's actually a great museum in the Jewish quarter in the house where they were. That's the picture that you see here on the right. Okay, let us move on and go on to our 1948 story. Okay, so this is important. We were going to get to it last time. We didn't really. Who are the defenders, right? All of these groups are essentially illegal, right? The British know they exist, but they're essentially illegal underground movements. The most veteran and the most, we'll call, mainstream is the Haganah, over here on the left, right? I brought you these various, the symbols of the different movements, monuments. These two are monuments in Petah Tikva, but you have the symbol all over the place. The Haganah is an outgrowth of the very first Jewish defense organization, Hashomer. Okay? Hashomer created in the early 1900s by the people of the Second Aliyah. 1920, they create this larger organization called the Haganah. The Haganah grows out of the Shomer, and the IDF grows out of the Haganah. In 1931, Zaev Jabotinsky and the revisionists, right, the counter movement to Ben Gurion and the labor Zionists, comes along and says, we need an organization that is going to be more, for lack of a better word, aggressive or right wing. And he creates what's called the Irgun Tzva'i Lelumi, or the Etzel, or more normally called just the Irgun. And that's the picture that you have here in the middle, and their slogan, Rak Kach, only this way. And you can see the picture is very descriptive, right? It's a hand clutching a gun over the map of Israel. But notice that the map of Israel is the map of Israel, which has two banks to the Jordan, as the song for Beitar goes, Shtei Gdot LaYarden, Zo Shelanu Zo Gam Ken. There are two banks to the Jordan. One is ours, and so is the other, right? And that's the original vision of Beitar, is to have not just Israel, but Jordan, right? Really Eretz Yisrael HaShlema, the whole Eretz Yisrael. So this is a newer organization founded in 1931, whose most famous leader is Menachem Begin. From 43 to 48. We'll talk about Begin in a minute. And in 1940, another group breaks away, and that's the one here on the right, called the Lehi. The clenched fist, right? The freedom fighters of Israel, Lochamei Cheirut Yisrael, led by somebody named Avraham Stern. And the impetus for creating this group was 1940, right? World War II has broken out. The Haganah and the Irgun both say, well, we and the British at this point have a common enemy. Right, our common enemy, of course, is the Nazis. So for the moment, say the Haganah and the Irgun, we will agree to join forces with the British and not fight against them, because we want to defeat this common enemy. And the Lehi says, what are you talking about? Right, of course we're going to fight against the Nazis, but we are still going to continue the national struggle against the British. So they break away and create their own organization. Right, all three of these organizations have common goals, but different methodologies, right? The goals are to defend the Jews against the Arabs, to fight the British so that they will leave and there will be sovereignty. They are all involved in what is commonly called illegal immigration, right? Or Aliyah Bet, bringing in Jews after the British have severely restricted immigration, bringing in arms. But each organization and its own measure of aggressiveness. And sadly, but not so surprisingly, the organizations fight with each other as well. Let's take a look at a few important leaders. Okay, the most famous one, of course, and the most important one here is David Ben-Gurion. who is not a young man anymore at this point. Remember, we saw him coming in that second Aliyah, right, being a young law student in Istanbul. By this point, he is not the prime minister because there isn't a state yet, but what we'll call the proto-prime minister, the guy who makes all the decisions, the de facto leader of the Yishuv, and he is the one who is the last, you know, authority in the war, making a lot of very difficult decisions, right, decisions which people could argue with. For example, prioritizing Jerusalem over other places, saying that the road to Jerusalem has to be open, sending Holocaust survivors, in some cases, literally off of the boat and into battle. But there were not that many choices in those days, and he makes the hard decisions. And he's very much the George Washington of this story, even if you don't always agree with his politics. In the middle, of course, we have Menachem Begin in a very, very classic pose. Menachem Begin was the orator, right? He knew how to fire up a crowd in the most powerful way. If you have any, go on YouTube and find any clips of him. He's electrifying, right? However he speaks, he's funny, he's brilliant. He leads the Irgun. He's in Europe, right? He's in Poland, then he's in Russia. He's captured by the communists. He's sent to Siberia, but he makes his way to the land of Israel, and he becomes the head of the Irgun in 1943. And very soon he becomes the number one, right? Going to the post office, most wanted number one guy for the British is Menachem Begin, and he has to go underground. But he leads the Irgun from underground, and such things as the Akko prison breakout and the attack on the King David, the bombing of the King David, and all different kinds of things from hiding, basically. When the British leave, he comes out and he remains the leader of the opposition for quite a long time until he finally wins in 1977, but that's a story in and of itself. And finally, I brought a few leaders here. One, the older man here on the left is Yitzhak Sadeh. Yitzhak Sadeh was the commander of the Palmach. Palmach is a fascinating thing, the Plugot Machatz, the strike forces. This was the elite unit of the Haganah. They're the ones who suffered the most in the War of Independence. Out of those 6,000 casualties, about a third of them are from the Palmach. But the Palmach, ironically, is created by the British. Okay? When the Nazis are making their way across North Africa towards the land of Israel, the British know they're going to need backup. And so they actually train a Jewish strike force, which is the Palmach. Now, when Rommel is defeated at El Alamein, thank God, right, and the Nazis retreat and don't make it to the shores of the land of Israel, the British, of course, disband the Palmach. But the Palmach doesn't disband. It just goes underground and it remains training. And again, they are some of the most important battles of the War of Independence. Next to him is Yigal Alon, who becomes the commander of the Palmach after him, and then he's a general in the IDF during the war. So we have, and of course there are many other leaders, but these are some important ones. Okay, let's take a look at these two plans because they are significant to understand, right? To understand what's going on in terms of settlement in the land. Take a look at the Peel Commission on the left here, and you can see the red outline. This is what the Peel Commission gave as the Jewish state. Everything else, except for the cross-hatched bit in the middle here, which is international, everything else is the Arab state. Now, why do they create this plan? Because in 1937, this is pretty much what things look like. Jews were living mostly along the coast and in the Galilee. Arabs were living in the mountains. And they basically said, okay, nobody's really living in the Negev, maybe a few Bedouin. We'll give that to the Arabs as well. Now, the Peel Commission, which, by the way, the Haganah is listening to in real time because it's being held in the Palace Hotel, which today is the Waldorf Astoria in Jerusalem. The Palace Hotel was built by Arabs. It was actually built by the Mufti, but with a Jewish contractor named Baruch Katinka. Baruch Katinka was a member of the Haganah, and he knew all of the plans and everything about the hotel. Oh, shoot, what just happened? Are we still here? Everybody here?
We're here? Yeah, we're all still here.
Okay, I don't know what just happened. And Baruch Katinka manages to figure out a way to bug the ballroom where the Peel Commission are holding their meetings so that the Haganah is literally listening in real time. It's amazing. So this plan doesn't get put into action, but the Yishuv learns a very important lesson. And that lesson is if you don't have facts on the ground, okay, you will not get anything. And they utilize the next 10 years to start settling in the Negev, which is not very easy. They have to deal with water. That's a whole story in and of itself. But they managed to settle in the Negev so that by the time the UN Commission comes 10 years later, the Jews come and they say, look, look, we've made the desert flower. And look at the UN plan. Also, not a good plan, but the Jews got much more, right? In this case, we get that same coast, half of the Galil and the whole Negev, right? The whole Negev. And that's a huge difference. And that's a huge lesson that is learned by the Yishuv. But this is a terrible plan in and of itself, right? Jerusalem, which has 1/6 of the Jewish population, is isolated with deep within Arab territory, right? And it's meant to be international. The passageways are very, very narrow. It's really would be very difficult for either side to have a state. But of course, the Jews accept this plan. The Arabs reject it. But when the war breaks out, Ben-Gurion basically says, okay, we would have accepted this plan, but since you went to war, whatever happens at the end is what happens. And ultimately what happens is that all of this remains within the Jewish state. So the entire Galilee, okay, plus half of Jerusalem, right? This is a very bad map, but you know what I'm doing here, more or less, right? It looks more or less like this, right? That goes to Jordan and the other part goes to Israel. Okay, over there. So we got more than what partition would have given us, but still, of course, not what we will get in the Six-Day War, but that's for the very last one. Okay. Now, it's very clear to everyone in the Yishuv by the end of the 30s that there's going to be a war and we're going to need munitions and we're going to have to figure out what to do. So some of it is smuggled, some of it is homemade, some of it is borrowed, shall we say, from the British. But there's something that is, it can't really be taken piecemeal. It has to be really manufactured because you need a lot of it, and that's bullets. Okay. So already in 1938, the Haganah sends someone named Yehuda Arazi to Poland to buy old bullet-making machines. And through a very long and complicated story, they end up being smuggled into the land of Israel piece by piece. It takes a very long time. But ultimately, they are brought to a kibbutz right outside of Rehovot. Okay? Where do they put these machines? They build a structure underground, literally across the train tracks from a British army camp. Okay? With the logic being, well, the British would never think the Jews are stupid enough to do that. Everything is very audacious, very chutzpahdik. They build in 3 weeks these deep structures in the ground, coated in concrete, put buildings on top, a laundromat and a bakery for air, right, for ventilation. And they put these machines down here and they start to churn out bullets. Now, they need to have people who are going to do this. And the people have to do everything in secrecy, obviously, because this is not, this is completely illegal. The British would just shut everything down. And it is indeed very secret. There are people in the kibbutz that one member of a couple worked underground and the other one was unaware. Right. And people were much more quiet in the 40s than they are today. And even today, there's plenty of people who are in the army who you have no idea what they're doing. This is a place called Machon Ayalon today. It's within the boundaries of Rehovot. It's an amazing place to go visit. But I'll just tell you that in the 3 years that these machines are working from 45 to 48, after 48, they can be, you know, taken out. They don't have to be underground anymore. In those 3 years, they produced 2 million bullets, which is not so much in modern standards, but this was enough for what we needed for the war. But more astounding than the number of bullets is the fact that A, they weren't caught, and B, in those 3 years, there was not a single fatality, right? Which is incredible, because they're working with explosives in a very closed in place, encased in concrete. Any explosion that would have happened there would have killed everybody, and nothing happened, right? Nobody was hurt. It really was an unbelievably miraculous story. Something else that we didn't have, tanks. Okay. What did Israel have? Israel had these trucks you can see on the left here that are called armored cars, Mishuryanim, but they are made into armored cars by a method called sandwich, right? A sandwich. What's the sandwich? I don't know what's going on with my internet. I apologize. The sandwich is that there's the truck, and then on the inside and on the outside, they put a layer of metal. Okay, put a layer of metal, and that's meant to protect it. And you have these tiny little windows. This may provide some protection, but it is most definitely not a tank. And Israel needed tanks. And that's where you get the story of the two tanks. One, you see one here on the right, the Cromwell tanks. Okay, Cromwell tanks, British tanks, a very good quality tanks. And the British are definitely not giving them to us. But here's where we get to the story of two British soldiers, one Irish and one Scottish, Mike Flanagan and Harry MacDonald, who were no great lovers of the British Empire. And they were actually great lovers of the Jews because they both had Jewish girlfriends. And they served in a British base in Haifa. And, you know, there was probably an informer or two that told the Haganai guys, tipped them off to look out for these guys. And they met up with these guys at a bar one night, and they're sitting and they buy them drinks. Well, maybe you could help us out with a couple of weapons. What do you think? And Flanagan and MacDonald say, well, would you like some tanks? And the Jews say, oh, yeah, we'd like some tanks. And they say, well, we think we can get you four tanks. We can drive two of them. Can you guys drive tanks? And the Haganah guys say, well, we've never driven tanks before. And the British guys say, that's okay. Tomorrow night, we'll come to your apartment and we'll set up some chairs in the living room and we'll show you how to drive a tank, right? Now, learning how to drive a tank on chairs in the living room, not so effective, right? So when the night comes, they choose to do it the night before the British are leaving. There's wild partying in the base. Nobody's paying any attention. Flanagan and MacDonald get on their tanks. They start them up. Great. Everything's good. Haganah guys get on their tanks. No, can't get them started. Okay, it doesn't work. But the two British guys managed to get the tanks out, managed to drive them on the highway, okay, to an Israeli army base. And these tanks served us very well in the war. Now, Mike Flanagan actually stayed on in Israel. He converted. He married his Jewish girlfriend. His grandson, whose name is Lior Hertz, served in the tank division. Okay, he was in Shiryon, and when he finished the army, he decided he wanted to honor his grandfather, who was a good Irishman, liked a nice beer, and he created a brewery where he made a beer called 1948 in honor of his grandfather. So that's the story of the tanks. Now, all of this, the things that are not stolen, to speak plainly, need a lot of money. Okay, now we are post World War II. There are a lot of weapons floating around Europe, as long as you have the money. We don't have any money. Okay, so here's where we get the amazing story of Golda Meir. Okay, Golda Meir, we all know who Golda Meir is, and she's a politician and she's important in the whole, early state. But basically, in January of 48, The yeshiva is thinking, where are we getting money? And they're hoping that maybe they can get $10 million if they're incredibly, incredibly lucky and they can buy some arms. But who's going to go and raise the money? So Golda goes to Ben Gurion and she says, look, I'm not a soldier. I'm not a general. I can't help you with the war, but I'm a pretty good speaker and fundraiser, right? And send me to America. So here she is in a picture. This is actually in Israel. This is a picture in Haifa. But she was, she looks like a plain old grandma. She was an electrifying speaker. And Ben Gurion says, okay, go. January 48, she lands in New York, and she immediately sets up a meeting with all these machers, right? All these big names in Chicago. And they look at her, really? Okay, fine. We'll do you a chesed. You can come and speak to us. But they don't think anything is going to happen. And she gets up in front of all of these wealthy American Jews, and she says to them, if you do not open up your wallets and your checkbooks now, the experiment of the Jews in Israel is over. Okay? Not in 6 months, not in a month. You have to give me money now, because otherwise we will not survive. And she says it a lot better than I do. And she doesn't even finish speaking. They're rushing the podium. They can't give her money fast enough. And she goes on and she continues to speak all over the states. And she comes back, not with the $10 million that they had hoped, with $50 million, $50 million, okay, 1948 dollars. And that money is the money that is what was used to purchase the arms. Without that, there's no way that we would have been able to survive in battle without those kinds of arms. So she really was unbelievable, unbelievable. Ben-Gurion called her the only man in his cabinet. She didn't necessarily think that was a compliment, right? But that's Golda. Now we're flipping back and forth a little bit here. We were talking about the story of the arms. That was in January 48. We're stepping back to July 47 for a minute, because this is a different story. And this is the story of illegal Aliyah, okay? But the most spectacular of the illegal immigration ships. And that, of course, is the Exodus, okay? Yitziat Eropa Tafshin Zayin. Now the British are restricting immigration, restricting, terrible limits on how many Jews can come at the time when they most need to come, from 1939 when the war begins, and of course from 45 when the DP camps are filled with people. And what do the Jews do? They launch what's called Aliyah Bet or Ha'apala, right? Buying these broken down ships, usually with, getting Greek or Italian ships, sometimes captains, and sneaking in. But here, the Exodus, the story was not to sneak in, but to break the blockade, to run the blockade. Sometimes the ships made it in, sometimes the ships were captured, and the Jews were sent to Cyprus or to Atlit in the land of Israel. But here, it was very clear this was going to be to make a statement. So July of 47, they take this ship, the President Warfield, you can see the condition that it's in, they pack it to the brim with 4,500 Jews coming from DP camps, and they burst through the blockade. They want to be caught, and the British capture it July 18th. There's battles, and the British, in a punitive measure, which is probably their worst decision, they say, we're not sending these guys to Cyprus or to Atlit. We're sending them back to France, and they send them back to France. And in France, the refugees refuse to get off the boat and they start a hunger strike. And they do a hunger strike for 24 days until the British finally, in their probably worst PR move ever, send the ship back to Germany. Okay. Now, the handsome fellow in the middle was a Christian Zionist, a priest named John Growl, and he came on board ship as the staff, and he was the guy who was sent out, that the Haganah sent to speak to the reporters. And everybody's eating up the story. It's an amazing story. It's splashed all over the front pages all over the world. And here's the sympathetic priest, and here are these refugees, and you're sending them back to Germany. And this created such an outcry that really that's why the Exodus got the name, the ship that launched the state, because this pushed the UN to say the British are clearly not acting sensibly here and we have to come up with a different solution. Now, it took 70 years. It took till 2017 for there to be a memorial to the Exodus in Haifa. And that's the picture that you see here on the right, the anchor stuck into the map of the state of Israel. But of course, the Exodus is immortalized in film. Paul Newman, who could forget, and it's an amazing story. Okay, so we finally get to that vote, right? Now, the vote is a dramatic story in and of itself. The Yishuv sends people to New York to negotiate, to bribe with the various delegates, and we've all seen or heard the pictures, the recording. Right, the recording of the different, reading out the countries, yes, no, abstain. But many of us have also seen pictures of people sitting by their radio, right, with a little notepad, writing down how many, yes, how many, no, because no one knew till it was over if it was going to pass. Now, ultimately, it passes with a lot, and that's the picture you're seeing here on the left. Okay, the green are yes, 33 vote yes. The brown are no, 13. You can see very clearly the brown is mostly the Arab states. And 10, including Great Britain, abstain. Okay, 10 abstain. The red one is Thailand or Siam, as it was called then, and they were absent. They didn't show up that day. The guy slept in. Okay, but 33 yes, 13 no, 10 abstain. The vote passes. Right, the vote passes. Now, one thing to notice, and I always think this is very powerful. Rav Soloveitchik Zatzal wrote a very important article called "Kol Dodi Dofek." Right, the voice of my beloved is knocking, and he says there are certain things that happened in the 20th century that show that God is knocking on the door, the redemption is coming. And he says one of them is the fact that the United States and the Soviet Union both vote yes, right? They're voting the same on this issue, which I don't know if it never happened again, but it certainly was very, very rare. Now, in Israel, people go crazy, right? And the picture here on the right is the the plaza in front of the Jewish Agency buildings on King George Street in Jerusalem. People just pour into the street, pour into the street. They're celebrating. The person who comes out to speak is, again, our Golda Meir. And she says, this is a moment we've waited for and prayed for 2,000 years. And now that it's here, there are no words with which to describe it. By the way, just a fascinating side note, the same day is when the first of the Dead Sea Scrolls is seen, right, by Professor Eliezer Sukenik. It was brought to an antiquities dealer in Bethlehem, and Sukenik sees it on that day, on the day that the UN votes to create a Jewish state. But meanwhile, Ben-Gurion describes himself as in mourning among the celebrants, because he knows what's going to happen next, and this is what's going to happen next. Of course, the first stage of the battles, the very next day, Arabs attack a bus near Petah Tikva, and the battles begin on the roads. Right? And the road to Jerusalem is one of the major roads, because Jerusalem is a major prize for the Arabs. Like we said, a sixth of the Jewish population, plus the morale, importance of Jerusalem to the Jewish people. But it's not only Jerusalem. They attack the roads in the Galilee, in the Negev, in the Gush. Take a look at this picture. This picture amazes me. I just discovered it this year after telling this story for so many years. This picture here on the left is a picture of the road to Jerusalem, right? Anybody who's been to Israel and has seen the road to Jerusalem, you know, six-lane highway today, tunnels, this was what the road looked like. And it helps you to understand how it was so easy for the Arabs to attack. Basically, the trucks came in convoys. They're coming up from Tel Aviv towards Jerusalem, 1940 trucks laden down, armored, right? Very, very heavy, puffing up the hill towards Jerusalem. And it's a very narrow road. And the Arabs control the hillsides on both sides. All they have to do, run down the hill, lay out a barrier, right? A mahsam that you can see here, blocking the first truck. And then they run down the hill, as the picture you can see here on the right, attack the trucks, kill the people manning the trucks, take the supplies. For the Arabs, it's a win-win. The supplies don't get to Jerusalem. The Haganah loses its trucks, and they get all the supplies. And the situation becomes more and more dire. And like I said, this is happening in other places as well. Not only food, but water also, right? Water, lifeline for places like the Negev and Jerusalem that don't have steady supplies of water. Okay, so take a look. This is the picture on the left here. The Palmach units were sent down to the Negev to guard the water pipes, because there's one pipe going to these isolated communities. And you had, and if the Arabs come, very simple to come, cut the pipe, and there's no water. And if there's no water, nobody survives. Jerusalem, a little bit more complex. Okay, the main pipes were cut. The main water coming from Rosh Ha'ayin, Ras Al Ain, which was an Arab town at the time. But Jerusalem has cisterns, many cisterns, rainwater collected over the winter. The government of the city, basically the military governor, Dov Yosef, nationalizes these cisterns. You know, it says they all belong now to the city. And the water is taken over and is distributed to different neighborhoods. And everybody got a ration of water every day. And the distributors are the Michalkei Hamayim. People who know the neighborhood of Katamon know there's a street called Water Distributor Street, Michalkei Hamayim, because this was a very important and not particularly safe job. Now, a sign that went up all over was this, right? What you see here, how to use your water effectively, because water, of course, is not only for drinking, it's for cooking, it's for cleaning, it's for laundry, it's for flushing the toilet. So you need to recycle your water and save your water. And even today, right, real veteran Yerushalmim never wash dishes leaving the water running. You have a basin, you soap it up, you rinse it off, right? And that's from the years of the hard years, right? The years of drought. But at a certain point, Ben-Gurion realizes that we can save and we can scrimp and we can ration and we can defend, but it's not going to work. It's not enough. And we need to go on the offensive. And that's when he makes the very dramatic decision to attack the Arab villages on the road to Jerusalem. Now, this is the beginning of April 48. The British are still here. Okay? It's essentially illegal to carry a gun, and Ben-Gurion wants to do a full military operation. The first place he's going to take is a place called the Castel. Okay? The Castel today across from Mevaseret Zion, right outside of Jerusalem. The highest point in the area. It was a Crusader fortress, hence the name, right? The Castel. And then it became an Arab village looking down on the road to Jerusalem. The Mukhtar's house, the head of the village's house, was basically the highest point. And from there, they would attack. And this was going to be the first stage in taking back the road. The night between April 2nd and April 3rd, the Jews get together. They scrape together whatever arms they have. They storm the mountain and they manage to capture it. But like everything in 1948, there are not enough people. There are no reinforcements. So these exhausted and wounded fighters are staying up, holding on to the castle. The Arabs have run away, but they have no one to relieve them. Now, a few nights later, the night between the 7th and the 8th, you have people on guard, right? Haganah members on guard. And they hear some people coming up the hill. And they say, of course, you know, who goes there? And the three who are coming answer in English, right? They say something like, hello, boys. And the Haganah guys figure this is a little strange. They figure we're going to shoot first. We're going to ask questions later. They shoot these three guys. Now, what they don't realize is that one of these guys is this handsome fellow in the middle. Okay, his name is Abdel Kader al-Husseini. He is the nephew of the Mufti of Jerusalem, of Haj Amin al-Husseini. He's one of the most charismatic, most talented military leaders of the Arabs. And we've just killed him, but we don't know that. Now, the Arabs do know that. They figure it out pretty soon. And that night, in a revenge attack, they storm the castle and retake it. The Jews flee. Now, this is a terrible blow, and we can't do that. We can't allow that to happen because Jerusalem is going to starve. So Ben-Gurion says, we're going back. We're going back the next day. And the next day, they scrape together whatever they have. They get ready for a terrible battle. They go to get to the mountain. They climb to the top, and nobody's there because the Arab defenders had left to go to Jerusalem to the funeral of Abdel Kader al-Husseini, and they had abandoned the castle. And that's why we got back the castle. We hold on to it. Little by little, we get the other... communities as well, and the road is opened up. But there are people who fall in these battles, of course. And if you look at the picture here on the right, this is the memorial site on the castle. Unfortunately, we have memorial sites in so many places in Israel. And this is the soldiers who were there, who were killed there. But one of the things that's very important about the castle, it's really one of the first major battles. It's the first major battle that the Haganah has. And in it, we have the principle that is a guiding principle in the Israeli army till today, which is that the lower ranks, the privates, retreat and the commanders stay behind to cover, as opposed to other armies where you get the commanders, the important guys out, right? And the rest of them are cannon fodder. In the Israeli army, the commander is the father figure. The commander has to protect his soldiers and he stays behind. And that's why we have, unfortunately, a very high percentage of commanders who are killed because they are protecting those under them. Now, we manage to take communities along the road, right? We take the Castel, Beit Machzir, Saris, and we've gotten the road from Shar Hagai, right? From the gateway to the valley to Jerusalem is open. From Tel Aviv to Shar Hagai is open, but in the middle is this one place called Latrun. Okay. Latrun, also a Crusader fortress, high up on the hill. The British take it over. They construct a very formidable fortress and prison here. That's what you see here on the left. And the Jordanians manage to capture it. And this is the bottleneck, right? The trucks can come from Tel Aviv to Latrun. They can go from Latrun to Jerusalem, but they can't pass Latrun. And obviously, this is a very severe problem. And just waiting for this to come back. Please come back. Okay. Got to speak to the internet people. Ben-Gurion orders a battle to take Latrun, not just one battle, three battles. Okay? Three attempts to take Latrun. The end of May, two attempts, the beginning of June, one. In these battles, by the way, there are quite a few Holocaust survivors literally off the boat 48 hours earlier who are sent into battle. Also in these battles, there's someone who is almost mortally wounded, and he's taken off the battlefield by a comrade, and his life is saved. And this is a young man whose name is Ariel Sharon, who recovers and obviously becomes very important in Israeli history. But these three battles do not work. We don't manage to take Latrun, but we still have to save Jerusalem. Jerusalem is going to starve. And so what they do is they create something called the Burma Road, right? We are not in Burma, but this was a technique that was used in the British in World War II to create this kind of a road is a very generous term, right? Basically a trail that's cleared more or less so that trucks could go through it. This is happening, by the way, during the first ceasefire in the summer of 48. The Arabs don't even bother to come and to bomb and attack it because they say, this is crazy. The Jews, let them spend their time and energy doing, they're never going to make a road. And they make a road, right? And they make a road. And you can see here the trucks, in this case, being pulled by a bulldozer, but it's enough of a passageway that food can be brought to Jerusalem, and Jerusalem is saved. Now, another very important story that has not a very happy ending is the story of Gush Etzion. Okay, Gush Etzion, south of Jerusalem, settled in the 20s and destroyed in the 29 riots, settled in the 30s and destroyed in the Arab revolt from 36 to 39. Third attempt in the 40s, fourth thriving communities, three religious, one secular, a lot of Holocaust survivors in these communities. And when partition is created and the war breaks out, Gush Etzion is actually included in the Arab part of partition. And the members of Gush Etzion, of the communities, have to decide, should they stay, right, and hold on with their very limited resources, protecting the road to Jerusalem? They're located between two major Arab towns, Hebron and Beit Lechem. Should they stay or should they evacuate to Jerusalem and combine resources with the people of Jerusalem? Ultimately, the decision is made to evacuate the children and the mothers. We're going to see one story at the end here where one of the mothers decides not to leave, but most of the mothers and the children evacuate to Jerusalem in March of 48. The men, the single women, stay behind to defend. Three of the communities fall in May 11th, 12th. Of 1948, Kfar Etzion is the last one to hold out, and the defenders are in a bunker here, as you can see. Finally, May 13th, the day before the state is declared, the Arabs break through the gates of the kibbutz. The Jews realize that there's nothing they can do. They surrender, and when they surrender, the Jordanians take them and massacre them. They line them up and they shoot them. 127 people who are killed in the final battle. Right, terrible, terrible, terrible story. This is happening on the 4th of Iyar. Right, this is happening the day before the state is declared. Now, you know that in Israel, the 4th of Iyar is Memorial Day, is Yom HaZikaron, and the 5th of Iyar is Independence Day. Now, the idea is that we can't celebrate independence without realizing and thanking those who died to create the state. But there's also very much a connection to the story of Gush Etzion. This is Gush Etzion's personal Memorial Day, and it became the National Memorial Day. Now, the very next day, right, the British are going to leave. The Jews have to decide, should they declare the state now or not? And you say, of course they're going to declare the state. No, they understand that declaring the state now means the Arab nations will invade. And this is a very, very crucial decision. And Ben-Gurion calls a meeting of the cabinet of the Minhelet Ha'am, which is normally 13 members, but two were in Jerusalem and couldn't get there. This is held in Tel Aviv. One is in the United States. So there's only 10 members who come to vote. And the vote, should we create a state now or wait? The vote is 6-4. 6-4 in favor of creating the state. One vote, right? One vote in the balance. And they decide they're going to do it. Here are the British leaving Haifa port. Where are they going to do the state declaration? Really, it should be Jerusalem, but Jerusalem is besieged. So it has to be in Tel Aviv. Where do they do it in Tel Aviv? In what was originally, in the original first neighborhood of Tel Aviv, in one of the leaders of the community, Mayor Dizengoff, who becomes the mayor of Tel Aviv, his house becomes the Tel Aviv Art Museum. Today, it's a building on Rothschild Boulevard, in the center of the financial district in Tel Aviv. It's a museum, and it's part of something that was created in 2017 in honor of Israel's 70th birthday, the Independence Trail, right? The Independence Trail, which is sites connected to early Tel Aviv and connected to the story of the declaration. It's on Friday afternoon because the British are leaving on Shabbat on May 15th. You can't declare a Jewish state on Shabbat. That's not right, right? So they decide to do it on Friday afternoon, and they send out invitations to a very select number of people. Take a look at the invitation. It's a great invitation, right? First of all, just look at the date, right? Dalet Iyar. And it says, "Hinenu mitkabdim lishloch b'zeh hazmana l'moshav hachrazat ha'atzmaut." We are honored to invite you to the meeting where we will declare independence. Right? Where is it going to be? What's it going to be? But the best part is this part: "Anu mivakshim lishmor b'sod et tochen hazmana v'moed kinus hamoita." Please keep this a secret. Okay? Now, when you tell 200 Jews to keep something a secret, you can imagine how many Jews knew about what was going to happen. And we have pictures of the whole area and the street in front of the building packed with people because everybody knew it was going to happen. And they declare the state, and the rabbi who's there, Rabbi Fishman, says the Shechayanu, and they sing Hatikva. And it's a very powerful, very beautiful moment. But it's happening as war is literally raging all over the country, and more is to come. And the very next day, of course, the Egyptians invade from the south. The Iraqi Liberation Army and the Syrians and the Lebanese from the north and from the east, the Jordanians from further down in the east. One of the major attempts is the Egyptians are trying to get to Tel Aviv, coming up through the Negev, and they encounter, very unexpected to them at least, resistance from the small Jewish communities along the way. Okay, the very first day, the first kibbutz that they get to is the Kibbutz Nirim. Small, tiny community. They got nothing. They got no weapons, but they managed to hold off the Egyptians really just with their bravery. The memorial here in Nirim has a slogan that was written in the dining room of the kibbutz, which says, "Lo hatank yinatzeach ki im ha'adam." It's not the tank that will win, but the person. And they are incredibly, incredibly valiant. And the Egyptians have to take a different route, and they encounter the next kibbutz, which puts up resistance, which is Yad Mordechai. Here's Abba Kovner, a survivor of the battles of the Vilna Ghetto. And they hold out, again, with nothing, for 5 days. Now, all of this resistance, even though ultimately it doesn't succeed, but it's very important because number one, the Egyptians are freaked out. They figure it was going to be an easy path. They're just going to mow their way through to Tel Aviv. And suddenly there's all this resistance. Plus, they have to divert. They have to go in different ways than they had planned to go through Arab areas and thereby save a lot of Jews. Ultimately, they get all the way to almost to what today is Ashdod, to a bridge that today is called the Ad Halom Bridge. Then it wasn't called that. Ad Halom means till here, right? Up until here. Now the Haganah comes and blows up the bridge, but that's not really enough. But what happens then is at this point, right, we're at the end of May, we have gotten some planes. Woohoo! We've gotten 4 falling apart planes from Czechoslovakia. One of the pilots is Azar Weitzman, who trained to be a pilot in the Royal Air Force, in the British Royal Air Force. Later, he becomes president of Israel, but he's the head of the Air Force for a while. And they dive bomb, right, with the planes, the Egyptian forces. Now, they can't really do very much, but the Egyptians don't know that. And they're terrified, and they turn around. Right? They're in Ashdod. They're a few kilometers away from Tel Aviv. They turn around and they retreat. And that's why it's called Ad Halom, up until here. Today, if you go and visit this site, so of course, there's a memorial to the battle and the Israeli soldiers. That's the picture in the middle. But something slightly more unusual is there's a memorial to the Egyptian soldiers. And that's the picture you have here on the right, the obelisk, right? In the peace agreements that Menachem Begin and Anwar Sadat made at the end of the 70s, this was one of the conditions, that there should be a memorial to the Egyptian soldiers who fell in Israel. So that's really a very unusual thing. Okay, one final very significant battle, very significant defeat, even though there are not so many people, but it's very important, is the Jewish Quarter. Okay, the Jewish Quarter in the Old City. the most lengthy battle. Okay, they are basically attacked from November 30th, 47 until May 28th. The Jewish quarter falls May 28th, 48, 6 full months of siege and battle. They're really a siege within a siege. Jerusalem is besieged. The Jewish quarter in the Old City surrounded by Arabs. So they're a siege within a siege in terms of supplies. And ultimately, the Jordanians conquer. And these pictures are from the destruction from when the Jordanians blow up the Churva Synagogue and the Tiferet Yisrael Synagogue and the Porat Yosef Yeshiva. But before that happens, right, in the middle of May, May 18th, the Haganah attempts to bring some help, right, to break through. And they manage to break in by Zion Gate, and they bring supplies and they bring relief, and the Jews are thrilled. And then they see them packing up to leave. And they say, what are you doing? You can't leave. And middle of May, everything is breaking out all over. There's battles all over the country. And the decision is made, and it's a decision that is still being argued about to this day, that they can't stay. And they have to go and fight elsewhere. And they leave, they retreat, they leave the defenders of the Jewish quarter to their own devices. And 10 days later, the Jewish quarter surrenders. This is an amazing picture of the super young Jewish commander Moshe Rosenach, 2021, signing the surrender agreement. The Jordanian general Abdallah Attal tells the Jews, the whoever's left, to assemble in the square, the Bate Mahsa square in the Jewish quarter. And when they assemble and they stand up and he has the man line up with their arms, right, he looks at them and he says, if I had known that these were your forces, I would have come with sticks and not with guns, right? They had nothing. And they're taken out of Zion Gate and not knowing that they're going to return 19 years later. It's a very difficult, very tragic moment. The photographs, by the way, we have photographs because there was this life photographer, John Phillips, you can see his name down here, who managed to sneak in to get into the Old City in these last 10 days and to take incredible, incredible pictures. And today it's a book called A Will to Survive. If you can find it on eBay, very worthwhile. Now, the Jews in the Jewish quarter, the ones who fell in the Jewish quarter were actually buried in the Jewish quarter against Jewish rules of purity, and you don't bury people near where you live, but it was a siege. They had no choice. And they were buried in the Jewish quarter, and it was only after the Six-Day War that their bodies were exhumed and they were buried together on the Mount of Olives. But because they didn't have graves in a place that could be visited, because this was obviously in Jordan, it was off limits to Jews, the whole Old City, there are a number of memorials that were created between 48 and 67. One is on Mount Zion. Okay, next time we're going to talk about Mount Zion between 48 and 67, how it stayed within Israeli hands, even though it's on the edge of the Old City. So this is a memorial there. But there's another memorial that was created on Mount Herzl, and it's still there today, of course. Both of them are still around. And you can see it's meant to look like an alleyway in the Old City, but the really amazing thing about it is the verse that's written here. There are two verses. One of them says, "V'atzmotechem kadesha tifrachna," your bones should flourish like grass. This is a verse from the end of the book of Isaiah. It's not the first verse you think of when you think of Jerusalem, and yet they chose this. 40 years later, 45 years later, when they uncovered in the excavations that they did by the southern part of the Western Wall, they uncovered a stone that had this written as graffiti on it from hundreds and hundreds of years ago. Some Jewish traveler came to Jerusalem and wrote this verse. So it's a little bit creepy, but kind of cool. Okay, two final stories about women. Okay. One is the beautiful family picture on the right here. This is Tzipora and Yechiel Rosenfeld and their baby Yossi. Tzipora and Yechiel were both teenagers in the Holocaust. They survived. They met each other after the war. They came to Israel. They settled in Kfar Etzion. And we said a lot of Holocaust survivors, they begin to rebuild their lives again. They have this baby. And when the war breaks out, like we said, the kibbutz decides to evacuate the mothers and the children. And Tzipora is torn. On the one hand, she wants to be with her child. On the other hand, she doesn't want to abandon her husband, and she doesn't want to abandon her home. She's a survivor. I'm not running anymore, right? This is it. I'm at the end of the line. And up until the convoys come to take the children and the mothers to Jerusalem, she's torn. And finally, she decides she's going to send her son with the other mothers. He's well taken care of. And she stays behind, and she fights. And she's one of the fiercest fighters. They both fall in the final battle. Yossi is an orphan from both parents. He was brought up by the other members of the community of Kfar Etzion. But Tzipora Rosenfeld was known as one of the most fierce fighters in the war. But some of the terrible dilemmas that you had to make, choices that you had to make. The other picture on the left here, this beautiful young woman, Zohara Levitov. She was a member of the Palmach. She was a very active member, took part in battles. And in the Palmach, she met someone named Shmulik Kaufman. They fell in love. They were released from the Palmach in early May 47, right? They're put in reserve duty. And they planned to get married. Only on the day they were released, Shmulik was called back. It was emergency training exercise. And he's killed in the training exercise. And Zohara, of course, is heartbroken. She goes to America for a little while. And eventually she ends up in California and she learns how to be a pilot. And when war breaks out, 6 months later, she returns and she's a pilot. Right? She's a pilot for the Palmach. And in August of 48, she's flying her plane in the Valley of the Cross and the plane crashes and she dies. And she had always wanted to be buried next to Shmulik, but Shmulik was buried on the Mount of Olives. By August 48, the Mount of Olives was in Jordanian hands. So she couldn't be buried on the Mount of Olives. She's buried in Mount Herzl. Now the story takes another twist. Shmulik, Zohara's brother, 15 years later, has a daughter and names the baby Zohara after his sister. Zohara, little Zohara, has cancer and she dies 6 years later. This is already 1969. The brother asks the Kaufman family if they would agree to bury little Zohara next to Shmulik on the Mount of Olives, and they do agree. So Zohara and Shmulik are reunited to a certain extent. And finally, we said this is a battle that left a very strong and traumatic imprint on Israeli society. And you can see that when you go to the military cemeteries. Early on, we don't have Mount Herzl yet during the war, but the Palmach has its own cemetery in kibbutz right outside of Jerusalem. That was one of their bases called Kiryat Anavim. And they created a military section, a Palmach section in the cemetery of the kibbutz. And you can see this monument here with the symbol of the Palmach on top. And this was where a lot of the Palmach members who were killed in the battles were buried. After the war is over, 1949, one of the first acts of the State of Israel is to bring Theodor Herzl's bones from Vienna to reinter him in the land of Israel, in Jerusalem, something that he had asked to be done because he knew there would be a State of Israel. They find a mountain on the edge of the city, on the western part of the city. They put Herzl there. They bury him there. They create what's called the pantheon, Chelkat Gedolei Auma, where all the leaders are supposed to be buried. Some are, some aren't. But right next to it, they create a military cemetery. And this is not the only military cemetery in Israel, unfortunately. Most cemeteries in Israel have a military section, but this is the largest and it has a lot of memorials. And when you walk through it, you can see the 48 section is very large, right? And to read the names is very revealing because you have a lot of immigrants. You have a lot of people coming from literally all over the Jewish diaspora. And one last thing that you have, and that's something you rarely have in Israel. Take a look at this picture up here on the right. It doesn't have a name. It says Almoni. Almoni means anonymous, okay? It's an unknown soldier. Israel has very few unknown soldiers for the simple fact that everybody knows somebody, everybody's related to somebody, everybody's connected to somebody. Who are the unknown soldiers? Unknown soldiers were the survivors who came and went into battle and were often the last ones of their family. And so people didn't know who they are. And that's when you see these unknown soldiers, almost always they're from 48. By the way, today we're actually identifying some of them, some crazy stories that are coming out. All right, let's take a look at questions, if we have any questions or comments. Ooh, lots of questions and comments. Okay, fires on Balmer hearing. Okay, the timeline. Yes, I will send the timeline. It can go up on the website. Sorry, I didn't do that before. Oh, Aryeh Halivni. Thank you, Dasi. I could not remember his name. That's the chauffeur blowers guy, Aryeh Halivni. Right, so why were the British against the Jews at the Kotel and not the Muslims? Excellent question. You know, there were a lot of anti-Semitic things that the British did, and the Kotel was definitely one of them. Oh, somebody's uncle was in the Lehi. That's very cool. Dr. Joseph Schwartz, I don't know. I would be happy to hear. I don't know anything about Dr. Joseph Schwartz. So anybody who wants to add something to that, please feel free. Algeria voted yes. Yes, that's an interesting quirk. And I didn't really look into it, but I'm assuming because Algeria was under the control of France, meaning they're not independent. Right, exactly. Algeria was controlled by France. New research proves on May 12th, the British were secretly asking the Egyptians to invade the Yishuv before the state was declared. Wow, I did not know this. I'd be curious to see this research. Do not know anything about this. Trying to save the old city, the biography of the chief rabbi of Haifa. Yeah, there are a lot of fascinating stories about the old city and those final battles. The graffiti was discovered by some teens on a summer trip to Israel. I'm not sure that's true. I think it was discovered by the archaeologist, but I do not know. Thank you, Roberta, on a family trip to the Castel. Okay, let's see. Unknown soldiers in the Kinneret Cemetery. Yes. Okay, it's not the only ones, but it's usually from Holocaust survivors. The other two tanks never made it out. The other two tanks stayed inside the base because the Haganah guys did not learn how to drive tanks by driving on living room chairs. Tries to identify the unknown soldiers. Very cool. Yeah, I'm sure there are some unbelievable stories. There are names that have been discovered literally 70 years later, like wild, wild stories. Yeah, Panim LaNoflim. Okay, I didn't know about that. Thank you. Latet Panim LaNoflim, the organization that identifies the unknown soldiers. Okay, I will look that up. Thank you. That's fascinating. Other questions, comments? We're good?
Thank you.
Okay. Next week, we are in a state, but we're going to see what happens. Lots of happenings, huge immigration, many, many challenges. Come back and you will see.
Okay. Yes, we look forward. Okay. Please God, I'll be back. And before next week, we have lots of other shiurim beginning this evening. Rebecca Winter, who taught Sefer Shoftim in the summer on our Tanakh series, wonderful teacher, we'll be teaching tonight, understanding the Mikateh. She's going to be talking about the story in class for this week's parsha. Tomorrow morning, I will be giving my Pirkei Avot here at 9:30. Just also on Sunday, Daniel Feldman's regular shiur is not taking place this Sunday. It'll resume, please God, next Sunday. But Rabbi Liebtag will be at 11 o'clock preparing for Har Sinai and Shavuot, the stories in the Parsha. And continuing Monday, Ari Shvat does the religious Zionist Hashkafa. You do the history. He does the Hashkafa, I would say. So very interesting. That's Monday at 11, Mark Shapiro in the evening, et cetera, all through the week. Sure, you see a schedule. We post it. We look forward to learning with you, hearing from you. Like I always say, please invite a friend who's never been to a Torah in Motion class. Invite them to come once, and I'm sure they'll come again. And nice to see everybody, and have a wonderful day. And actually, I hope the windows are all closed. And
they're all closed.
Okay.
Thank you, everyone. Shabbat shalom.
Shalom. Thank you, everybody. Have a wonderful day. We'll see you later. Bye-bye.